So thank you, Elsa, for your very convincing paper that made us dive into 18th century Venice. And I'm sure that there are many questions, not only from those specialized in Italian art.
There aren't so many of those here, I think.
Exactly.
So are there any questions? Yeah?
I'm just wondering whether in this painting deals with easel paintings, but are you interested also in the way that the festivals incorporated, well, first of all, maybe three-dimensional objects like sculptures or crucifixes, but also body parts in terms of relics of saints, especially looking at Italy? Is this something that would factor into your larger analysis, or are you really interested in the picture only?
Surely I want to look at the other objects too, but I'm actually so interested in easel paintings because there is this, of course there is something about the easel painting as a decidedly modern object, and so I'm really interested in how that suddenly becomes something that is being introduced in these processions and other kinds of events in a way that relics were always there from the start. Body parts and also three-dimensional objects such as sculptures. Sacred images were as well, but then the tableau as a new category of object, that is my particular interest here. Why suddenly does that become an object that needs to be there? Yeah.
I think the reason I'm thinking about it is because the way that the body is coming up in so many different ways in all of the presentations that we've had today, and yesterday too, actually, almost it's a thread that's coming through. Maybe the fact that the canvases are kind of popping out at this moment against a relief of the wider range of objects could be something to underline as well.
Sure, yeah, thank you. Yeah.
But thanks for taking us also to Italy. As people who deal with American art, most of the time we don't get there too often, so it's a nice escape.
I'm aware that Renaissance Italy is, well, I mean, this is 18th century, but early modern Italy in any case is so, well, we were talking about this yesterday, Christopher and I, it's perhaps the most traditional area of art history geographically, and so I'm very, very excited to be part of this particular conference for that reason also.
Thank you, so kind. Thank you. Could you go back to the engraving of Luca Carlo Varese?
Yes, sure.
Because there is... yes, that one. There is no procession. On the other hand, there is a big painting hanging from the, not hanging, but displayed in a way on the wall. So why is it so? Because normally they display paintings or tapestries because there is a procession. That's that we know. But in this case, there is not. And if it's whatever, the sun, the wind, the rain would damage it, so is it? It's temporary.
Yes. So this is part of these events around the 16th of August, and they would keep the paintings exhibited for slightly longer than only the day of the religious feast. So that's what you see here. So basically, the event is already over, but the painting, in this case, only one big painting. Whether that was ever the case, that there would be only one big painting, I don't know. It's at least what Carlo Varese has chosen to depict. But so this is, he suggests thereby that this is after that event. Yeah. And about the weather, yeah, I've wondered about that many times. But apparently it was not much of a problem. Or if it would rain, they would presumably take them away or take them inside. But there isn't that much mention of that in the... sources.
Thank you. That was really interesting. And I'm especially impressed by the way in which you used a painting. You described this as a painting that positioned the viewer as a participant, and that means that you've used the painting to evoke a certain kind of viewing practice in this period, right?
Yes.
And so I think that's fabulous. And so I'm wondering if you can extend that a bit and tell us a little bit about what was supposed to happen to the paintings on view and also the experience of viewing in this multisensory context. I mean, what is it, you know, now you've revealed what a kind of ideal viewing situation is, multisensory, dynamic. And so what was that, why was that the way to view these paintings? And what does it tell us about what happens to the paintings in the act of viewing?
Well, that's a very good question, and thank you for that. But and it's a crucial question, I think, but I don't know the answer to that question very well yet. In any case, what I'm also really interested in is this switch to viewing paintings in a museum context against a white wall, etc., where we don't speak and we stand still and we immerse ourselves, etc. That's what I sort of maybe in an exaggerated manner even, but that's what I'm trying to contrast this with. So I'm interested in viewing practices that are not in line with that modern ideal viewing, whereby of silent immersion and still immersion also. What this implies for the paintings and what would happen with them, in any case, that they're much more part of a sort of an interaction between viewers and between other objects than we might think. Because we nowadays tend to think about early modern Italian art also as something that belongs in a museum space and so forth. So I want to emphasize the interaction there. That's the best I can do for this answer. But thank you for the question.
Thank you.
If I just may add something to that, because this would have been actually my question. So since the topic of the section is visual environment, and in your paper you have convincingly shown to us the importance for the painting to a former audience located within a former context, so how would you comment on the exact environment in which the painting is presented nowadays, like in the National Gallery in London, and what does it do to the viewer who Canaletto construed in a way or articulated socially by placing him within the moving mass? So what is the interaction with this painting and the nowadays viewer in a museum context?
Well, I think it depends very much on what museums do with paintings. And the National Gallery is actually in some ways pretty good at bringing some of this, even though I'm not sure how aware they are of historical exhibition practices, but they're quite good actually at bringing other senses into the viewing. For example, they had a exhibition called Soundscapes last summer, in which they asked sound artists to make compositions for that you could then listen to while looking at selected paintings. They've also done a number of years ago an exhibition which took some of their masterpieces out into the streets of London. Not the actual paintings, but very high quality reproductions of them. And so they would hang these in the areas around the National Gallery, even also in the more shadier districts, especially actually, and making these paintings then interact with their environment there. So these are things that I'm very interested in.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
I have one.
I may be making a dreadful error, but I think the Scuola San Rocco already had, by Canaletto's time, a considerable number of paintings on its walls for well over 100 years. Was it Tintoretto's?
Yes, yeah.
Among others. So the scroll was already a museum, if I dare suggest that, a little bit. So there is a certain continuity between what we do in a museum today and what that audience would have been doing if it had gone into the Scuola to look at the paintings. Does this sort of create a rapprochement between the people in the square and ourselves? I've been in the Scuola a number of times, and it's just one massive gallery with things that can't travel to other museums, if I remember correctly, because they're painted on the walls. They have to take the walls away to circulate them. And the use of the Scuola in Canaletto seems to me somehow to have some very specific meaning, or significance in any case, simply as a place for displaying paintings. I don't know if I have a question to ask you. I just think that I'm struck by the fact that the Scuola was, even then, an extraordinary picture gallery.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've tried to emphasize this continuity also by talking very briefly about the earliest history of this confraternity. And right from the start, they started to invest in painting and sculpture and architecture. And indeed, so this is the building that has Canaletto paintings all over it, on the walls, on the ceilings. Did I say Canaletto paintings? I meant Tintoretto paintings. Yes, but they clearly function also in a religious, charitable context there. So the Scuola, as all the other institutions of its kind in Venice, functioned as a charity organization. So they brought together middle-class people, basically, who would take care of the poor there. And so you can also see these paintings by Tintoretto there as reflecting clearly on that kind of activity. So they, of course, they're all biblical scenes, and which have a very clear relation with the activities of that confraternity. So surely those paintings would have been visited by artists for their artistic importance, but at the same time they have a very clear message to tell about religious and charitable activity. But certainly it's no coincidence at all that it was this exhibition that became so important around this, in this place in the city that was already renowned for its art. Yeah, sure.
There is something, and I'm going into a different direction now. Could we maybe have the Canaletto once again? That is the relationship between the drapery on the left and the paintings. That strikes me particularly because there is even more emphasis on the drapes than on the paintings. Maybe it's just my impression, but is that a reflection on the medium, or is it a reflection on? Is it a hierarchy? What kind of a relationship would you think there is? Which is other than the which is different from the architecture.
Well, maybe it's not that different from the architecture. If you would say that the drapery is also more costly, possibly, than the paintings, at least it's this. Well, this isn't the case nowadays, I suppose, but for a very long time, tapestries would be much more costly than oil paintings, and much more valuable. So there possibly you can see that kind of hierarchy, although it's very hard to tell what exactly the quality of these draperies is. And the houses are quite humble, actually. They aren't Venice's biggest private palaces that you see here, so I'm not sure how likely it is that these draperies then, presumably owned, but again, we don't know, but presumably owned by the people who live there, that these would be the costliest of draperies. But there certainly is a kind of hierarchy, and I think also... the same could be true for the Scuola's architecture, which is, of course, much more durable than any oil painting will ever be. Yeah.
Mm. thank you. This is very interesting. And we had a chance to speak yesterday about how this relates to Japanese temples displaying all of their works once a year in these mm-hmm. impromptu exhibitions in the Middle Ages and early modernity. I'm struck by this canopy.
Yes.
It runs across horizontally, and it divides the space into a social space at the bottom and a pictorial band
yes.
above that, and then it cuts that pictorial band off from the rest.
Yes.
And so in your reading of a procession, it runs from right to left. It seems as if the procession is then one spectacle competing with the spectacle of the paintings behind it, but they're two mm-hmm. very different kinds of spectacles.
Yes.
So the procession has a clear head and a clear directionality and a vector, whereas the type of temporary exhibition you're talking about tends to divide social space into new ways, so that people clump underneath certain paintings and they use this space in a different manner because of the perspective system inside of the paintings themselves. So mm-hmm. in a way, I see the power of perspective of the meta picture as changing the way space is interpreted in the social realm
mm-hmm.
in a different way than the way you're reading it in terms of the procession. I mean, to me, I see the procession as being in contrast to what's happening with the pictures and what they're doing. So this leads to my question that may be unanswerable. But who curates this? Who determines where the paintings hang, what paintings hang, how high they hang? Because this seems to be the level of decisions that mm-hmm. that is, that's where a lot of the power is in these, and I
yes.
want to know who is exactly behind that.
Thank you for those observations. That's really helpful. The answer to your question is we don't know, unfortunately. So the confraternity clearly had a hand in this from these archival documents that I referred to. It appears that clearly something was getting messy before they started to take these exhibitions outside, so that suggests possibly that there wasn't that much curation at all. And then later, presumably, there was more control, but I don't know. I mean, again, the way Galletto has depicted this suggests that there is some hierarchy, and it seems that at least the biggest paintings are well central on the building, whereas the adjacent houses only have some smaller pictures, and there seems to be, you know, some system there, but that's really all
I guess
one can say about it.
But like the art historian in me wants there to be a chronological span. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
How is it oriented? Is it contemporary to the riot and older to the, like, that's, yeah.
Yes. Although that's even in this period, if you look at, we know a lot more about curation in the art galleries in this period. And there, it's like in the first half of the 18th century, there isn't always very clearly a hierarchy just yet. And also, if you look at the first salon exhibitions here in Paris, for example, there will be a lot of ordering in terms of size, rather than, and sometimes genre, rather than anything more systematic or more art historical.
Right.
But I take your point about the respective and the viewing of these pictures and the pictures, and I'm going to think more about that.